Good evening. This is the final class of this module called What Makes You Not a Buddhist, using the book What Makes You Not a Buddhist with the same name by Dzongsa Kensei Rinpoche. This is our last class, and I've entitled it Wrap It Up. And the reading was the conclusion, and anything else you haven't read so far. So we have now studied all four of the seals. All compounded things are impermanent. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. That's a hard one. And nirvana is beyond concepts, which is even harder. So there are three topics I'd actually like to work with tonight, so we're going to have to move it along. And actually, I have enough to say, so that I wrote out the whole thing in the form of an essay. I'm not going to read the essay, but the essay is online right now. So
we could just go to sleep now and look at it later.
Right. Okay. So there are three topics I'd like to cover. The first one is to finish up the last seal, which is nirvana is beyond concepts, and that is nirvana is beyond space and time. That's a real juicy one. And the last two are issues that came up in the conclusion, and they are not causing harm to sentient beings and renunciation, what it is, back to square one. So, nirvana is beyond space and time. Well, nirvana is beyond concepts. We discussed that last week. And space and time are beyond concepts. So, that makes it clear, right? Anyone going to buy that? Hope no one buys it. Okay, so, to actually see why nirvana is or even to start to see why nirvana is beyond space and time, we have to go a little deeper into what the four seals are. So we can only answer this question if we really study why we have the four seals to begin with. And we work with them because they are really bedrock reality. They aren't things we can simply discuss and agree with. They aren't things we can simply work out logically. They are what is ultimately real. And the only way to actually completely work with them is not just to understand them, but to be them. Sometimes we use the word grok them or whatever, but actually, to really have the four seals, we have to be the four seals. So they are what is genuine and authentic in our experience. And they are what liberates us. And the opposite of what liberates us is what keeps us confused. So being real is authentic and liberating, and not being real is being deluded or dwelling in ignorance. This is a very important point. What does ignorance mean? Can anyone tell me what ignorance means?
It means like lack of awareness.
Yeah. Right. Not being
stupid. It's not being.
So it doesn't mean not having certain information, not having an education, or not having certain facts or skills or anything. It means ignoring who we really and truly are. So that's ignorance. Yes?
I always wondered if you could define it as being ego.
Yeah. Okay.
Ego. Being ego.
dwelling on the belief that we are a self, as opposed to actually having the experience of no self. So there's a very fundamental point here, which is that authentic being is liberating, and dwelling in samsara, dwelling in ignorance, is imprisoning. That's a very important point. It really is imprisoning. So one thing that Buddhism will absolutely disagree with is anyone who says ignorance is bliss. So ignorance is what leads us to being imprisoned, and genuine being is what leads us to be free and not imprisoned. So why do I want to talk about this? We started talking about, the point was, time and space are beyond concept, right? Or how do we put it?
Nirvana is beyond time and space.
Nirvana is beyond time and space. Thank you. And we have a very hard time jumping there. We can't convince ourselves that nirvana is beyond time and space. We might have a little idea of it, but we can't just leap into it. And when we can't leap into something, when we can't see what kind of freedom is involved there, what's very helpful is to look at how we actually experience time. I want to talk about time. You can work about space if you want, but just time is good enough. So, is time freedom? Is it beyond concept, or is time a prison?
Prison?
Is it a prison?
I think so.
That's how you actually experience it, right? Yeah.
It's a measurement and a label.
Well, aside from that, if we experience it as a prison, it can actually make us depressed, withdrawn, exhausted, and make us feel not free. And I think that's basically how we experience it, that we are in a prison of time, and we are remorselessly dragged through it, whether we like it or not. If we think of our experience of time, I think that's what it is. It's like time is something that has put a rope around us, and we're being just dragged through it, and we don't like it. Is that how we experience it?
Well, maybe it's a convenience, though. I mean, I just went through all the dates and times we were going to meet, and it seems pretty helpful. I mean, if people show up on the right day, that's good. They don't show up at 9 o'clock at night or something.
Or sometimes they don't. Okay, so obviously time is used constructively to coordinate things.
Right.
But the attachment to it, though.
Well, how is the attachment to it? What is that actually like?
So if we're given the dates and times to be someplace,
right,
and we're stressing because we have other commitments that we have to do,
right,
and now we have a conflict, and now we don't have enough time.
Right.
And so it's just this, it's relentless, like you said, that this concept that it's almost like a commodity, and we don't have enough of it.
Mm. Yeah.
I think you're pointing out.
Yeah.
Or if you're miserable, then you have too much time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or you're in pain.
You're in pain.
Yeah.
So the nature of your experience of time all changes our state of mind. Yeah.
Okay, well, every woman in their 30s, for example, who would like to have a baby but doesn't have the right circumstances yet, experiences time as being dragged through it. That clock is ticking all the time. And then there's the experience of, I'm getting older. I'm gaining weight. I don't look as fresh as...
Michael.
Are getting skinny. I don't like it. I'm going to go and... there's a huge industry to go and deny this experience. And men suffer it too. Men feel They don't have as much energy. As we get older, we're dragged through not having the sexual power we had when we were young. And whether we're male or female in our body, we're subject to cancer, heart attacks. Maybe we're going to experience senility or Alzheimer's disease. So the overall experience is, gee, if I had what I want, I would stop that clock, right? I would make it useful sometimes, but basically I would stop all the things that I don't like about it, being dragged through life until it's over.
Well, that's such a negative attitude. I don't
well, if you could have a different attitude, that would be good. I don't believe you can.
I don't think everybody has it. I mean, I would hope not. I mean, yeah.
Well, you
no
could hope not, but you can't actually. But it's not true.
Does it mean
that hope isn't true?
Does it mean you don't enjoy the moment that you're in?
Well, yeah, we can enjoy the moment we're in. But then it comes back, right?
At some point, so that's life.
Ah, okay. So the best we can hope for in life is to put up a stiff upper lip and be a stoic.
No!
No? Well, what other alternative do you see?
That's what we're about here. This is the stiff upper lip group. Everybody practice.
Okay, well, there are other alternatives.
Like I'm talking to Eeyore.
What?
I feel like I'm talking to
you. You could also view it in terms of time. One of the things that I got, Krishnamurti, who was an important teacher,
uh-huh,
he repeated again and again the notion that thought is time. And that basically what it means to be trapped.
Yeah, but I really want to get our teeth to experience.
Well, I'm trying to help people understand what you're saying here, Michael. Yeah. You're really making it sound too literal and not helping people grasp where they get locked into the notion that time is real, and that's the problem. Excuse me. You go ahead, but
no,
I mean,
okay,
and it's all our thoughts.
Go on, okay.
Right.
Can be a problem, isn't all.
No, we're going, all right, let him finish and then be happy with him. We'll be happy to discuss it first.
Well, we can put it out of mind, right? We can not think it, we can decide, I don't want to dwell on this. And we can put it underground. I mean, some people, it comes out as instability and crazy acting out and stuff. But a lot of us have it quite together, in which case, basically, I think I would say we're Stoics. We see that realistically, I can't escape this. I'm not going to let it get to me too much. So I'm going to be a decent person. But I really haven't resolved it deep inside. What were you going to say? Yeah.
I would agree with that.
What?
I would agree with what you said. I mean, mm-hmm. I think we all kind of come to the realization that we have this, like, a finite amount of time on this mm-hmm. planet, and there's nothing we can do about that. So we just kind of accept it and then move on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we've solved what time is.
Yeah. And it eats at us underneath.
Yeah, it eats at us underneath subconsciously, most likely, because though maybe it's not in the forefront of our mind, it's still there. It's still It still probably motivates you to do a certain pursue a certain aspect of your life as opposed to another, because hey, I don't have all the time in the world, so I'm gonna go and pursue this, but still we still don't know what time is, or we can't solve it.
And it bothers us.
Erica has
something. What? Erica?
Do you have something else?
Oh, yeah. No, I've been agreeing with
you. Oh, okay.
And also how we compare our use of time with other people's use of time.
Yeah, and we could feel envy.
He's eloquent. Yeah. He didn't. He's 2 years younger than I am.
What? sorry?
You know, somebody's way more accomplished than you are, and you're the same age or something.
Right, yeah.
Just this whole... So as you get older, the reality that you're going to die just like everybody else does, that eats at you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to go through unpleasantnesses.
Yeah, or you can try to think, okay, well, what am I going to do to live longer or to be better or have a better life because I'm going to get older, so why don't we exercise voraciously and do this and eat that way, and you know, and then, you know, have a heart attack anyway. So it's like, it's very, you know, it's sort of like then you realize, okay, there's only so much you can do to stave off the inevitable. But there is this underlying feeling, I guess I do have to agree with you, that there's some sense of there's this ground is shaky underneath the whole thing. There's no way to fix it.
If we don't practice meditation at all, then we have lots of alternatives. Like any time this little bit of intelligence bubbles up, we can watch television, go out, have a drink. There's any number of ways we can escape. And it's not, yeah, distractions. If we meditate, we start to see that they are distractions. It's not that they're good or bad, but that we know we're distracting ourselves. We start to see that underneath we really haven't solved it. So, how does the experience beyond space and time dawn on us? So we might actually get a glimpse of being fully awake, of a life that's intense, colorful, and emotional, not emotionally suppressed, but without any self to own it. This is actually possible, and momentarily we might get it, but we can't hold it, right? We're not really realized yet, and it's very hard to hold it. And we can't say, well, I'm going to hold it by sitting very still until I take some leap, and then I'm going to get there. It doesn't work. We take the leap and we're still where we are, basically. So the alternative to that is actually to tune right into our experience and be very attentive to what it is. And we have a lot of practices to do that. This is very important, that to understand anything like this, to benefit from it, we have to bring our practice into it. So we've been given the practice of shamatha, or basic sitting, which everyone here does and is the most important thing because it helps us, just the fact that we sit for this hour teaches us that we don't have to jump up and run away because we're afraid of our mind. That's tremendously important. Then we've been given practices and we've been working on them for quite a few months now, and several different approaches to working with the emotionality of our mind. And we have Lojong and the practice of Tonglen, which is an extremely powerful and advanced practice. And if we want to really do it, it's up to us to actually keep working at it, keep working at the Tonglen, keep working at the slogans, and use them to go beyond, to basically to purify our mind, gradually to purify our mind to the point where more openness becomes possible. So if we detect some sort of subtle resentment, and we've talked about that already, we could actually on the spot bring up a slogan such as drive all blames into oneself, or be grateful to everyone. Our tendency is not to want to do this, but we could actually start to do this and see how that over time starts to liberate our mind. Or we just start to get a sense of how we spend all our time thinking about me and what I want and what I don't want and so on. So we could come up with a slogan, all Dharma agrees at one point, which is to diminish this overwhelming sense of self. And we're constantly trying to do things, and sometimes they work out, sometimes they don't work out, and So we can again use a slogan such as, whichever of the two occurs, be patient. However, these are just examples. To really do this practice, you have to work at it. You have to read it, you have to bring it to mind, and then you have to apply it right at the moment that some subtle little thought comes up, and that subtle thought comes up because we're meditators. Does that make sense? Any comment on that?
I had a quick comment before you get away from too far.
Yeah.
You said we wanted to start with time.
Yeah.
Beyond time. I can grasp that, but what does beyond space, I can't even understand that. What is that?
Well, maybe you have a long commute and you wish you could get there instantly. I don't know. I mean, we could work on that. I thought time I could try to make rather vivid more easily. Think about that. I don't have a lot to say.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Maybe
yes.
If I meditate with you next in 2 weeks and I'm in Italy and you're here, there you go, I'm beyond space because I'm doing the same thing. I'm connecting with you and I was already thinking that when you do this in the morning, I can do that, the same thing there. I believe it's something that... It's like here now could be anywhere, yesterday, tomorrow, without thinking that, it's hard for me to explain English, give it in Italian. But anyway, that could be maybe silly example, but you know, an example, because what I see now and what I, the people that I'm connecting with now, they speak a different language, not from mine, but from the people that I meditate with in Italy. They're dressed in a different way. They walk in a different way. They do meditation, you know, walking differently. You know, this is different. But in fact, it's the same. And so time and space, well, in this case, space is here, there, but which is all part of one soul, one mind, I believe. That's what I want.
When I get it, I think of it in terms of being beyond causes and conditions. When you're thinking about a place, you're thinking about a situation that has, you know, weather patterns and temperature, and it has colors, and it has flavors and textures. And so nirvana as being something beyond time and place, as being something simply that's unconditioned. That's what it refers to. It doesn't mean you aren't in a particular situation. Everybody is where they are. But we're not letting that somehow determine our awareness itself. The awareness itself is fundamentally free. It has no kind, it's self-existing, it has no kind of birth or death. And it has no kind of shape or form to it. So from that point of view, it's beyond thought, it's beyond the grasping of thought. We talked about that, the grasping of mind. We can't grasp emptiness and we can't grasp nirvana, which is basically what we say is the freedom from samsara, right? Which is just being that very thing, being caught up, being entrapped, enslaved by our notions of everything, time and place. Does that make sense? Does that help you?
Yeah. You'd like to have a time machine, an instant travel machine, right? Then you could be in two places at once.
Well, you said something really wonderful that actually triggered something for me, which is that here and now has no affiliation. Mm. Here and now is always unaffiliated because it's always here and now, which is always different from a millisecond ago. So there's no, it was quite lovely how you said that.
So, are you also saying then that here and now is always the same?
It's always the same and completely different.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And completely unaffiliated with.
And unrepressed.
Yeah, any time and place, because you can't pin down time.
But I mean, even like last night during the Dante session, I went with Michael and Emily, and you know, and then of course Dante the Italian poet that
we we're studying Dante.
Okay, and then for instance, it was amazing because they just reminded me about Ulysses and his quest, you know, of going beyond time and space. Not time, but space, but it could be meant in the same way. And some things, and then I'm thinking of Columbus, and I was just making a funny, you know, remark. I thought, you know, if he wasn't so brave, you guys would be.
We'd all be in Italy.
We'd all be different, you know, and who knows what the world would be like, etc. If they just make a funny thing. But it's art is for me. Meditation is definitely the key. But art, maybe because I'm a writer and I can master time and space because I can be in different places, you know. So for example, now some people are reading my things in Italy online, and then I can post things about you. But I can also say today what happened yesterday, and just put it all, you know. So that's why now and then, and doesn't really matter sometimes in art, for instance, you know. And Dante lived 6 centuries ago and 8 or how many they really are. And then you feel things that he said, he knew about meditation, he knew about Buddhism, but he wasn't a Buddhist, you know what I'm saying? So the spirit that was back then in some minds like his and other minds that were privileged because, of course, you know, Buddhists couldn't have been for everybody back then. You know, now I think we're privileged too because we're all more or less educated people, I think. You know, I mean, at least in Italy, the target of people is that of somebody who really is aware and not ignorant, you know. So if you have other problems like feeding your kids maybe or, you know, losing your job, you don't have time to do this, but... and yet, you know, Dante talks about this, basically, you know, talks about not being aware, you know, being lazy, being too busy, you know, the search for truth and to elevate ourselves, to, you know, get nirvana, basically. He called it in a different way, but I think that's what he meant, you know. And this means that we're all, you know, time in this case doesn't really matter. Doesn't matter in the Middle Ages they killed people in a certain way, or, you know, or if they ate different things, or if they dressed differently. The spirit is the same, I think, and will always be the same, you know. I mean, what they did in India, what they thought there, we're thinking here now, we're worshipping more or less the same concepts, which makes us all... similar, you know. So there you go. Space is, you know.
If we actually understood it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's easy to say.
Okay. So, practice really is the only way to understand this, as far as I know. As opposed to just talking about what it might be like or making a hypothetical. And I'd like to leave you with. Something very important that we've all gotten from our teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche. He was very fond of saying that enlightenment is the death of ego. The death of ego, the death of the sense of self. But as we practice, our intelligence starts to become very sharp, and the ego, the self, starts to become very, very clever. And to think of things that seem almost like nirvana, but really have a subtle aspect of ego. That is, what ego really wants to do is to attend its own funeral. It really wants to do this. And so it wants to do something which is... That's
that.
A good. That's okay, good. Well, I'm glad because I want you to keep this in mind. The self cannot attend its own funeral. This is not possible. Therefore, when ego starts to really understand this, it can start to become very terrifying. In other words, we really, at some point, have to go through a great deal of fear, because self has to die to. Get to the other side. So how we work with the fear that comes up is very important. And what normally happens is that people get a whiff of it and they run off. And it's only through our consistent practice, hitting it again and again, touching on fear, that we have to stay with the fear and work through the fear. That's in Dante too. But it's very vivid in our teaching. And it has to be completely personalized. And it takes, we actually have to work to do it. We can't think our way through it.
But when you say fear, Michael, do you mean something like a metaphor, or you really?
I certainly don't mean a metaphor.
Like I can be panicked when I'm reaching a certain level.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely, yes. There's no metaphor here. This is not about metaphors or explanations, okay? This is what really happens.
Yeah.
And it happens because to get to the other side is a death-like experience.
I like to pick that up on the egoless, the death of ego.
Yeah.
Is that to me, the attack of a beyond space and time is, I put it a different way, without space and time. And for this reason, I like eventually getting to the point of egoless, you know, without an ego. Then these are constructs, time and space are constructs. And so without ego, you are without those constructs, those boundaries, or those whatever words we used in the beginning. And so we're saying, what would it be like to be fully alive without this consciousness boundary forcing a representation? And so it's beyond. It's without time. It's without space, and I don't know, the mathematicians have generally...
Yeah, but you're trying to guess it, okay? You're trying to use ego to make a guess about it, okay? That's what you're doing right now.
At the end of his book, he does a whole bunch of...
he says all kinds of
things. ...represent what it is without ego.
Yeah, he talks about a variety of ways which might spark something in you. What I'm saying is that we have to do our own individual work, and that work means that we have to go beyond our fear, okay? You cannot come up with a theory to make a detour around that. Any kind of theory.
No, but what I'm trying to get to is the word beyond. I think we're inserting a fear, let's say, but the without ego, we don't know what it's like, but it's a real state.
No, it's what already is here. Okay, you can't make a theory. You're trying to, but you can't.
I'm not making a theory. I'm just trying to say, isn't there an entire controversy in Buddhism about is emptiness an academic explanation, or is it a real thing?
Well, you can work on that as much as you want to, and eventually you'll die. But what good is that going to do you? You cannot make any theory, any controversy, anything you can do to detour around the fact that we have to go into our own fears with our own practice personally. Each of us has to do that.
I agree that you can't come up with a theory and then understand what egolessness is, but isn't a theory necessary for it to be expressed to the group of people?
We come up with explanations of various kinds, and we have to understand that they are explanations, okay? They don't...
You can describe a flower, but a flower is a flower. And you can use all sorts of language to describe a flower. But
right.
Flower itself is itself beyond.
But you still, but I feel like you still need, in order to communicate with other people, you still need a theory. And the theory is
you need a practice, and you need the company of other people. That's enormously important. And we can encourage each other.
Just to be clear about words here, you are talking about whether we need a doctrine. I mean, there is a central doctrine to Buddhism,
right,
fundamental tenets that help us understand how it is distinct from other traditions that are spiritual paths. And the key point is egolessness.
That is
the key, that's the hallmark of the specific distinctive element that sets Buddhism apart from all other paths, because it fundamentally makes the most radical statement that has ever been made, that we don't exist. and then that's coming from a direct insight.
Right.
The insight has to come from the experience, and the experience comes from the practice. So to simplify, but we do have these doctrines. We do have frameworks to help us understand how we're working. Why are we sitting in the first place? Why do I want to meditate? Obviously, we have a roadmap, and Buddhism is wonderful for roadmaps.
Right.
So that's
just like a signpost for what we're trying to get to or trying to understand. But I think it's what the difficulty is that we would never be able to understand what egolessness is without initial concept or idea of someone experiencing it.
That's right. That's why we have 50-something slogans, okay?
Right.
So that we can use them at the moment a glimpse comes that I'm so centered on my own thought. You can say, all Dharma agrees at one point, you can jump there but that's work, okay?
Yeah.
It's work, it's personal work, and it will raise fear. Guaranteed.
Although the fear is already there. And I think that was, when we really started out this course, one of the first things we talked about was how hope and fear are the basis for our basic confusion. And then it takes on all these forms. So if we're going to get to what we would call openness, complete, just simply primordial state, then, we have to encounter this hope and fear, which is fundamentally cloaking the whole thing and putting these colored glasses on us to make us see things other than what they are. And so we talk about work on ourselves. I mean, we're working on ourselves on many different sides. We're working on ourselves in terms of seeing our habitual patterns. We're realizing how we continually replicate and fill up space and try to affirm somehow self-existence. This is kind of oversimplifying, but because it manifests in many different ways.
So that's filling space. Making it crowded, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm sorry, I have to go.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And, good luck, and I will be in touch with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
I will do that, definitely. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Okay, so...
Wait, John.
Yeah. I have a question, because there are some aspects of what we're talking about tonight. I get the notion that ego is problematic at a minimum, that the reaction to challenging it is fear, and that this seal, the Nirvana's Gaya concept, is signpost. But what I don't understand is, what is the practical purpose of that signpost?
To liberate us.
Well, I take me back, bring me, like, that's way over there.
That's way over there.
We're talking about seeing the truth. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
We're seeing reality as it is. This is all about reality. The other word, the word Dharma has many different meanings in Sanskrit that translated into English, application. It can mean a thing, it can mean a doctrine, the Buddhist Dharma or whatever. It can also mean truth,
okay.
Just where it is. So basically, when we're talking about seeing the Dharma of a situation, we're seeing the truth of the reality of the situation. So the four Dharmas, these are also Dharmas in a sense. Dharma, you'll find that word used many times. These seals, or the four truths, the four noble truths, have to do with what allows us to pick ourselves up out of this cloud of confusion and discover the true nature.
In other words, we have tools and we have a path to work with.
Are you asking, why do it at all? I mean, not a
No, I don't think I am. I'm because I can see why we do what we do, and I can see benefit, and I can see that it is, you know, it's, there's some natural truth in it, right? I think even the teacher or reading says that. But this idea of the ultimate truth, I guess, Nirvana, as beyond, like talking about a thing that's beyond concepts as a road sign to where we're going seems really far flung. Like how does that help? So, right?
But that's what we have. You know, you understand that our minds use concepts in order to communicate.
Okay.
So that's perfect. We're not against concepts. It's not like concepts are bad. That we just recognize their limit in terms of their function and use. When concepts refer to something beyond, now even when we talk about a flower, she just mentioned the idea of a flower a minute ago. I mean, concept, flower, but to look at the flower is not a concept. It's a direct experience. So, you know, what we're talking about is using these concepts to point to something that is beyond that concept. It's like the finger pointing at the moon. We're not looking at the finger. We want to look at what the finger is pointing to.
Right. Okay, so we're hinting at an experience, or a, well, maybe it's not even an experience.
No.
It is.
It is?
Yeah, but the experience is, already happening.
But we don't see it. So, for instance, on the walk outside, mm-hmm. when I walked across the grass after we were circling back up by the tree, there was a mushroom.
Yeah.
Boom!
Yes.
Boom! It was that moment of seeing the mushroom. I noticed just the space of that. It was totally awake that moment. And then I labeled it right away. I noticed my label, mushroom. As soon as I label it mushroom, the immediate experience was gone. So what we're going for here is the concept actually is a veil that clouds over our experience. And we can't help it. We're always, immediately goes a label. Oh, kid crying. Okay. But you're not even hearing, or motorcycle. But we're not with what's really happening because the label actually separates us from it, from whatever's going on. So it's a convenience. So we're talking here about the ultimate, you use that word, ultimate truth. So that's, the relative truth is, you know, okay, we're going to meet at whatever hour. There's the relative truth and we agree there's some kind of consensus reality. But, you know, it's pretty boring if we're going to be stuck there. We're talking about the ultimate truth. So, okay, Michael.
Okay,
where,
so, yeah.
That's,
I, we do need to move on, though.
That was, but your question has been just eating at me for a long time reading this book when we got to the emptiness one. And then finally, he comes on page 78, the benefits of understanding.
Okay.
I thought, oh, he's addressing the subject. He knows what,
Exactly. So
and
we
I
have.
Think wait, when wait. I got to benefits of understanding, and then. In Nirvana's Beyond Concepts, he begins to work on, he was beginning to work on me, or it was beginning my, what is this relevance? What's useful about it? I had the exact same problem. And you know, if you're really with the love and compassion, and, you know, so he lets up a little bit. He does. And I just found that was, very
well,
from like 78 to
like
the end of Nirvana's concept beyond concepts, I found very.
Yeah, that's the important thing. There is no separation. We didn't go into this in great detail. There is no separation between emptiness and compassion. This is the very
key
point.
It gets to something that really.
Yeah, what we're getting to is that we actually have a path, and that we can work, and that there is a possibility of gradually purifying ourselves and starting to get glimpses. And we can work on this. This is not a practice book, but we have to join it with our practices if we get any benefit of it. all this talk that he's doing or anyone else is doing isn't going to do anything if we don't bring it right to our practice. If you had a different tradition, you'd have a different practice. But this is the practices we have now of sitting meditation and working with our emotions, including particularly Tonglen and the Lojong slogans, and bringing it right in there. We are purifying ourselves over time. We're lightening our minds. It is happening. So we don't have to get it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it comes in glimpses. And so also notice when you're riled up. So that's a clue there's something there that could be, I mean, there's lots of reasons perhaps, but it could be ego's feeling threatened, and then there's some kind of a not, you know, like you're pushing back against it. So you can just keep approaching the things that are uncomfortable and you know, go towards it and then relax and go towards it. So you just keep approaching
working,
it.
Keep working on it.
You can't take a hammer and bang yourself over the head.
But I think sometimes intellectually, I think what we try to do intellectually when we can't get our head around it is to put it in a compartment and intellectualize it and try to find answers.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And
that's why I've been trying to not allow too much attempt here to find the answers.
Right.
What we do is, if it bothers us, look at our bother. Okay?
Yeah.
Right.
Take
it
back.
And it bothers us, look at our bother.
Some sort of a structure.
Yeah. Right.
Okay, this is
right.
this, and then
right.
that means
that's
this,
okay.
and A plus B equals C. And that's what we try to do to get our heads around it, because we want to rationalize it as opposed to experience and
right.
let go to it.
Right.
I think, though, that sometimes you can start that way, because it is a concept. So
right.
I was talking with you about one of the things I do is, my traffic is my challenge. And I started to practice that when I'm in traffic, I find myself thinking a thought like, that person is taking too long. Is to say to myself, judgment. That's a judgment. That's
okay.
it. I'm not judging myself on it. I'm simply labeling it. It's a judgment. It's a label. But it's making me aware of what I'm doing.
Right.
So I am using a concept and I'm using a label,
mm-hmm.
but I'm using it to just simply be aware of what I'm doing in my head at that moment.
That is what the Lojong slogans are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's shortening
okay.
the span of your consciousness because
yeah.
you're catching yourself there.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
And I think that over time, I won't even have to say judgment. It's just that's the awareness of it right there, what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Onward.
Onward.
You sound time-driven.
Yeah, you're time-driven. Maybe you don't have anything.
Maybe I should keep everyone to 11. Is that okay?
Yeah.
No, but why do you have to cover everything on your paper?
I don't have to cover everything.
It's
on my
online.
Paper.
Let them read it. It's
okay.
Let them talk. Jeez, what are we here
I
for?
I think the important thing is that since this is the last class for this particular topic, exploring what we don't understand is what's important. If we're still,
right.
you know, having trouble with understanding how to relate between theory and practice, as it were, doctrine and practice, instructions and practice, that's really critical. So I thought, you know, being on the spot, and yes, I use my conceptual mind to help label the moment, and then I'm going to be there with it. That's the point. I'm not going to just go on from there. I mean, I'm actually, that's where everything stops. So we are connecting just these little dots.
Say that again.
Flashes.
We
little
are
dots.
Connecting.
Yeah, momentary flashes, momentary glimpses. We're not gonna, it doesn't mean that the glimpse I had yesterday has anything to do with where I am now. It just means that we're developing a sense of really being present. And those glimpses, they come in very short spurts, very little instant, often just instantaneous little glimpses. That's fine. In fact, the way Trungpa Rinpoche talked about it, he said, disown it. Once you have it, drop it, you know. We're here.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
If anyone has any
yes.
more concepts, I'm going to say, talk to me privately, okay?
Michael, relax, man. Just relax. What else do you want to say? You've got something on there you want to talk about. Go
yeah.
ahead.
Yeah, okay. The second one I'm not going to say. We're
okay.
going to skip because we
okay.
have only 5 minutes left.
All right.
But there was a major issue going on about eating meat and about what is the nature of not harming others. It's on the and how we can use our concepts about right and wrong to be very aggressive, and we need to go beyond them, and we need to get a bit bigger picture of what it means not to cause harm. So it's there in writing if you want to look at it, okay? So the last thing which he brought up was renunciation, or he called it richness within renunciation. And Trungpa Rinpoche, who sometimes called that back to square one. So what Kensei Rinpoche said was, we do not have to practice renunciation the way the Buddha did it, by necessarily leaving our family, doing great austerity practices and so on. He gave some examples of his own, but I wanted to leave you with the fundamental idea of what renunciation is, because we do need renunciation. And renunciation is giving up samsara, that is, giving up our wanting to dwell in confusion. That we've been, in some sense, we've been talking about that all the time. That is, to not give in to wanting to hang out in confusion and wanting to be awake and present. And that comes up in our meditation practice all the time. And it's extremely simple. We sit, and suddenly we realize that we've lost, we've forgotten the instruction, we're lost in our thoughts, something's happening. And that's not terrible. We can be very gentle and compassionate with ourselves. But the renunciation is when we know we have a thought, to come back, to be willing to give it up and come back to the practice. In other words, the temptation is to say, well, this is juicy. I want to figure out why I'm angry at him, or why I'm in love with that, or why this works this way, and I've been having this thought. And to start to analyze, the thought's juicy, we really don't want to leave it. If we can get back to the meditation, to land very simply in the meditation, that is the most important renunciation. Last week, Emily read a phrase about it. Awareness is the body of meditation as is taught. Whatever arises is fresh, the essence of realization. To this meditator who rests simply without altering it, grant your blessings so that my meditation is free from conception. So willingness to be present in great simplicity is the ultimate renunciation. Nothing else is really needed. So now we've come to the end of this module. We've talked about the four seals, which are all compounded things that are impermanent. I can't end without reading them. All emotions are pain. All things have no inherent existence. And nirvana is beyond concepts. And these are not ideas, they're not beliefs. They're the basic reality that we inevitably discover when we go beyond our personal, societal, and religious beliefs, when we drop them. If we followed the Zen path, we would have different techniques, koans or whatever, to get to the same place. If we followed a Christian, Muslim, or Hindu path, and we don't stop with conventional religion, but go beyond it conceptually, we still get to the same place, I believe. And Rumi, Meister Eckhart, Thomas Merton, and others have used their religion to come basically to the same thing that this teaching gives us. So I don't think it's a particularly Buddhist view. I think it's reality. So now that I've forced everyone along, does anyone have any
thoughts? I actually would disagree. I don't think that that Buddhism takes you to the same place that Christianity does. so I respectfully disagree, and we can carry this conversation on other conversations or other contexts, but I do believe there's something really quite different, and that if I look at studying these various saints in the Western and Eastern traditions, I find very different perceptions and very different what we would call resolutions or finalities. I don't think they're the same. This is just, you know, something to think about. We don't all have to agree about what we say here, but my belief or understanding and my experience tells me that this is, you know, gives us an opportunity to discover a freedom that's beyond anybody's notion of heaven or bliss or salvation or any of those kinds of things that are basically a characteristic of these other religions and religious traditions. That is true.
Buddhism is the only one I know of that has completely developed the way to dismantle itself. And other religions don't, but individuals in them, like the ones I mentioned, have.
Right, so people can go beyond their own, you know, the constraints.
And they're called heretics when they do it.
Yeah.
Well, awakened mind is beyond any ism whatsoever. Yeah. Beyond Buddhism. Beyond
of course it is.
Right.
Right.
And the Buddhist path is most, a most extraordinary path to that. But miraculous, the other books.
But it does leave us a capacity to go beyond Buddhism.
I'm sorry?
It leaves us a capacity to go beyond Buddhism. Mm-hmm. And as I think it was Suzuki Roshi said, you know, when you just practice, there's nothing left but ashes. There's nothing. It's all gone. There's no reference point going back to here's where we were, here's how we got here, all that. It's all gone.
Mm-hmm. I loved how you brought up panic. That's the reality of working on the path.
Right.
Versus the kind of, I'm a Buddhist and I meditate, which is easy to get stuck in.
Yeah.
So it's really great. That's subtle.
Well, let's recognize that we are. And using that word anxiety too, I think, you know, sometimes, you know, that kind of this underlying anxiety, that always resonates with me.
Because the temptation is always to do whatever it takes to feel better.
Right.
Because this is such a freaky, being alive, a grown up alive human is full of terror, you know, opportunities to be freaked out.
But I think underneath all of it, there's a fundamental drive for the truth.
Mm-hmm.
So whatever that stuff we're afraid of, whatever that stuff we're, you know, not understanding, we're sitting in this room right now. There's something pulling people in rooms all over the world, wanting something that is innately in there already.
But it does take courage to actually to look and to keep going on the path. That's why it helps to have a group or sangha to encourage each other and to sit together. I mean, I find that's really helpful. Mm-hmm. So,
And like Michael said, too, the distractions bubbling up. I mean, be it work or, you know, whatever other distraction, it's standing still really helps me here.
Does it feel like a distraction, or does it feel like it's just a part of the whole scheme of it for you?
I think it's a distraction for me. It's a distraction for conditioned response that I have, not knowing anything different.
I think it goes both ways for me. I have the idea that watching TV or going on the internet or what have you was a distraction, so for a long time I just like was aversive towards it. Mm-hmm. And now I see that as, wait, now my idea that it's a distraction is the distraction. Okay. That makes sense.
Uh-huh. Well,
that makes sense.
Yeah.
So now I can.
Can you stay aware of your mind while you're watching television?
Exactly. Or reading a book, or doing anything. It's very interesting.
Yeah.
You and I were talking earlier about transition. And I realized that I faced a lot of death in my life. And I just had to take a family pet to be put down earlier this week. And I wanted to be present. I was told, because it's a rabbit, they don't allow you to be present.
Oh,
really?
A rabbit?
Because rabbits react differently than other animals.
Oh.
And I called 3 different vets, all of them told me the same thing.
Wow.
And so I talked to one vet and I said, I've been with this rabbit for 12 years.
Wow.
I'm going to be there when it dies. And I said, listen, I grew up on a farm. I put down horses, dogs. I was there when my goddaughter died. I can handle a rabbit. And they said, okay. And they said, here's what you can expect. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay. So I showed up and I held the rabbit. And they injected, and they said, he's going to freak out. And he jerked, and they calmed right down. And I just talked to him and continuously pet him. And, and I got to be there and present for his whole death.
Mm.
And for me, that is a difficult moment, but the way that I see death is it's difficult, it's painful, and so I want to lean into it. So the idea of running away from it to me seems to be like why it's real, it's here, it's something we're all going to go through. And so I don't want to put a label of bravery on it. People say you're so brave. It's not. I don't feel brave.
Well, but I think the other thing we learn as we get further into practice and study is that we are experiencing birth and death all the time.
Yeah.
And we're just dulling over it. But it's actually happening all the time.
Yeah.
And if we really want to train for our death, which is a unique Buddhist possibility, we need to actually understand that we have all the material we need right now. And we can use a meditation practice to just basically learn about that and actually learn how to rest in that understanding and recognition, so that when the actual stage of the final physical death occurs, you know, we can recognize that and actually even rejoice in sort of the recognition, and because it's a very extraordinary time when that transition occurs.
And I was using my breathing when I was holding him, and I really do feel like that calmed him.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would you like me to pass this on?